All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 07-0490, Mann, Frankfurt, Stein, and Lipp Advisors, Inc., and others versus Brendan J. Fielding from Harris County and the First Court of Appeals District. Docket number 070806, Walter E. Harrell versus the State of Texas from Terry County and the Seventh Court of Appeals District. This cause is part of the Supreme Court's recent adoption of an appellate pro bono program in cooperation with the appellate section of the State Bar, and the court appreciates the assistance of the pro bono lawyers in that case. The third matter is 070970, Lori Smith and Howard Smith versus Patrick W.Y. Tam Trust from Collin County in the Fifth Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each argument. We will take a brief recess between the arguments and should complete all of them by noon. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 070490, Mann Frankfurt Stein versus Brendan J. Fielding.
Mr. Harris will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. The main issue in this case is whether the Covenants Not to Compete Act controls the award of attorney's fees, specifically whether Section 1552 preempts the claim for fees. The second issue I'll discuss is whether there is sufficient consideration for the client purchase provision in Fielding's employment agreement. I'll first address the preemption issue, and then I'll address the issue of consideration. Fielding's claim for attorney's fees is preempted by Section 1552 of the Covenant Not to Compete Act. The trial court held that Section 1552 preempted the claim for attorney's fees. The Court of Appeals reversed. The Court of Appeals said that Section 1552 does not apply here because this is an action attempting to prevent enforcement of a covenant not to compete, not an action to enforce a covenant not to compete. The Court of Appeals relied on another Court of Appeals decision. The court relied on the Gage Van Horn versus Tatum decision. In that case, the employee filed a declaratory judgment act seeking to construe a covenant not to compete. The employer later that same day filed a breach of contract action seeking damages on the covenant not to compete. The Eastland Court in the Gage Van Horn versus Tatum case determined that the action was not an action to enforce a covenant not to compete as defined in Section 1552. The reasoning of the court was that because the employee's declaratory judgment action was the first filed, that it couldn't be an action to enforce. The resulting rule is that Section 1552 preemption cannot apply where the employee is the first to file suit. That's the same reasoning that Fielding argued in this case of the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals in this case agreed with that. Section 1551 provides the circumstance where an employee can recover attorney's fees. And Section 1552 is clear that the remedies and procedures in Section 1551 are exclusive and preempt any other law. Although Section 1552 applies to an action to enforce a covenant not to compete, under the Court of Appeals rule, it can be circumvented just by an employee filing suit first. In this case, we're only talking about the preemption of attorney's fees, but the Court of Appeals rule, if it's right, will take away the preemption and exclusivity of all provisions of Section 1551. Under the Court of Appeals rule, Anytime the employee files first seeking a declaratory judgment, it will not be an action to enforce a covenant not to compete, and Section 1552 doesn't apply.
Would it preempt the attorney's private agreement in their contract? Because they agreed that the prevailing party would be able to recover attorney's fees.
Section 1552 says it preempts under common law or otherwise. It preempts all other statutes. There has been no argument in this case that it wouldn't preempt the contract, and I found no authority that would limit it to only a statute or anything other than the contract. The research I've done has not been able to turn up any authority that it would not extend to the preemption of the contract.
So you can't contract around it, would be your argument.
That's correct. This 1552 says it preempts under common law or otherwise, and that's an exclusive preemption, so there's no way to contract around it. Although 1552 applies to an action to enforce, it shouldn't be decided by a race to the courthouse. Preemption under Section 1552 should apply whether it's the employer that files first for breach of contract and then has the employee file a counterclaim for under the Declaratory Judgments Act seeking to have the covenant found invalid, or whether the opposite is true, whether it's the employee that gets to the courthouse first with the declaratory judgment proceeding asking to have the covenant not to compete construed to be invalid, and then it's the employer that files the counterclaim on the breach of contract.
What if there's no counterclaim?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What if there's no counterclaim for breach?
If there's no counterclaim for breach, I think that would be a different situation because there would be nothing in the case to enforce the covenant not to compete, but here there is. I mean, if it were...
So your position is limited to this one where there is a counterclaim for breach?
That's correct, but in all of the cases we have found, there has been the counterclaim for breach. The only case that we've seen that did not have the counterclaim for breach is the National Cafe Services case out of Waco, and there the employer, rather than filing a counterclaim for breach, asserted release. Because when the employee's when the employment was terminated, the employee signed a release. So the employer, in coming in to defend against the counterclaim or to defend against the declaratory judgment, instead of asserting the validity of the covenant not to compete, asserted release. And that's the only case that we've seen that did not have the counterclaim asserted for breach of the covenant not to compete. And even in that case, the Waco Court of Appeals said, you know, the original claim was the Declaratory Judgment Act to have the covenant not to complete declared invalid. And it noted that the employer did not seek to enforce the covenant. I mean, it was a very specific holding that the court didn't, that the court relied on, that the employer was not seeking to enforce it. So to answer your question, if there were no counterclaim of any sort, that would be a different case. But that's not the rule that was handed down in Tatum. Tatum has been followed by the Dallas Court of Appeals in the Strausser decision. Without any further discussion, the Dallas Court of Appeals chose to follow it. And there the courts are simply looking at who filed first. If the employee got to the courthouse first with the declaratory judgment action, then that will wipe out the Section 1552 preemption.
It remind me, is there something in the statute that says if you... the employer sues for breach, they can get attorney's fees?
The employer is able to get damages, and the damages provision typically allows attorney's fees. Attorney's fees aren't specifically mentioned for the employer.
Of course, damages often is not attorney's fees. You have damages in a tort claim, but that does not include attorney's fees.
That is typically true. I believe that's not an issue in this case, but I believe typically in covenant not to compete cases that employers are awarded damages, or are awarded attorney's fees under the damages provision.
I'm just wondering about this. I mean, that, you know, it's been the law for 100 years. If you breach a contract, the other side breaches the contract, and I have to sue them, then I get my damages and attorney's fees because they breached the contract. On the other hand, if I sue them for breach of contract and they have to defend and they win, they don't get attorney's fees. You don't get attorney's fees for defending breach of contract. So I'm wondering if this provision for attorney's fees in here, that you get your attorney's fees if you defend, was not intended to preempt get your attorney's fees if you breach, if the other side breaches, but this was just an addition rather than a substitution. It sounds to me, I mean, you're arguing that in fact this substitute, this is it, the only way you get attorney's fees under this act is by defending.
And that is the way 1551 has been construed. It has a very specific provision to allow the employee to recover attorney's fees. They're very specific.
Didn't normally do, but I'm isn't that just a supplement rather than a preemption and replacement?
Section 1552 says very clearly that 1551 is the exclusive method.
I know it says that, but if damages doesn't mean attorney's fees, which it doesn't in tort and lots of other areas, then we don't mean it to be exclusive, because nobody has ever thought that if you sue somebody for breaching the covenant, you can't get attorney's fees.
But Section 1552 doesn't use the word damages. It used the word remedies, and that would be sufficient to pick up attorney's fees. It's very specific. In the courts, whenever attorney's fees are not provided for in Section 1551, have been clear not to allow them.
But in any event, the plaintiff here is not suing for breach. Is there any allegation that your client breached?
No, that they are suing under the Declaratory Judgment Act just to have it declared.
Your client's enforcing exactly what was signed. That's just whether it violates the statute.
Absolutely. The Declaratory Judgment Action is just to have it construed to be not enforceable. And they have not attempted to claim fees under 1551.
That's what I was going to ask you. What disposition are you seeking? Would it be a render, or would it be a remand for a determination of attorney's fees under 1551?
It would be a rendition, because they have not sought that. They sought attorney's fees under the declaratory judgment action and under the breach of contract, under the language of the contract itself, under the agreement. The trial court and court of appeals disposed of the claim for the declaratory judgment action. So that's no longer an issue. The only issue before this court is whether Fielding is entitled to fees under the contract. And if 1552 preempts that, this court should render judgment that he take nothing on his claim for attorney's fees.
Since we've never answered that question before, do you think a remand in the interest of justice would be appropriate?
I don't believe it would, Judge. The issue has been up before this court, as you know, in Tatum. The court dismissed it as improperly granted because it wasn't preserved. 1551 is very clear. That is the provision that allows attorney's fees. 1552 is very clear that 1551 is the exclusive method for construing the procedures as well as the remedies under a covenant not to compete. So I believe the statute is clear that the court should not, in the interest of justice, issue a remand.
Well, and let me ask you, I wasn't real clear from your briefing. Are you claiming here that the covenant was reasonable? I mean, there's a little piece in your brief that the penalty provision really is not a penalty and it was reasonable. Do we have to address that issue first?
No, Your Honor, you don't. That was put in the brief to address some of the language in the Court of Appeals decision, talking more about the other agreement that's not an issue before the court, the one that dealt with the stock options, et cetera. But that isn't an issue here. The only issue that's before this court is really the issue of consideration on the covenant not to compete. That's the only issue that's here. Fielding's claim for attorney's fees is preempted by Section 1552 of the Covenant Not to Compete Act, and as a result, this court should reverse the judgment of the Court of Appeals and affirm the judgment of the trial court. Turning now to the issue of consideration, Mann Frankfurt gave consideration for the client purchase provision in the employment agreement, and there are two reasons why this consideration was sufficient. First, there was an implied promise by Mann Frankfurt that was later performed. And second, even if there was no implied promise, Mann Frankfurt actually performed, and that is sufficient to form a unilateral contract. There are two relevant provisions of the employment agreement. Paragraph 7 says that the employee shall not disclose any confidential information it receives from the employer. And paragraph 13 says that the employee will be working on client files that contain confidential information. There's also evidence in the record that Fielding's position gave him access to confidential information. These provisions are sufficient to form an implied promise that Fielding would receive confidential information.
Well, you don't really need an implied promise here, though, do you? Well,
that's right. Under the current state of the law, you don't. That's been an issue in the case, but clearly under Sheshinoff, but I think even under Light, you didn't to form a unilateral contract. And that's where the Court of Appeals got off track. The Court of Appeals said very clearly that an implied promise or a promise is required, and the fact that the consideration was actually given, that is, the confidential information was provided, was basically irrelevant. That is clearly wrong under Sheshinoff and Light.
The problem I have with the implied promise piece is the employee could not go and force the employer to reveal confidential information. And so it's kind of hard to imply a promise there if it's unenforceable by the employee.
And I understand. The key in a lot of the implied promise cases deal with access and whether the employee had access. The argument on the implied promise is basically if there were no implied promise to provide it, Section 7 and Section 13 of the employment agreement would basically be meaningless. That's why there should be an implied promise. Plus, his position actually gave him access. But as you noted, Your Honor, the court doesn't need to even find an implied promise because here there was actual performance. It's undisputed that the information was provided, and that was how the promise by Fielding was accepted. Fielding in the employment agreement promised not to disclose. Mann Frankfurt actually provided confidential information throughout his employment. That's sufficient for the unilateral contract. The Court of Appeals was in error in requiring that there be a promise on the part of Mann Frankfurt because under a unilateral contract, of course, there is only one promise, and that's the promise by the employee in this situation, which is actually accepted by performance. Mann Frankfurt provided the confidential information, and that isn't disputed, and Fielding had access to that throughout his employment, and that is sufficient to form a unilateral contract. And because there is sufficient consideration for the employment agreement, this court should also reverse on the issue of consideration and reverse the judgment.
What was the nature of that confidential information?
It was client list and other client information. They had all the client work papers, files, billing information, and that's discussed in the record on pages 803-04 and page 799 of the clerk's record. And I believe it's undisputed that the information was, in fact, confidential. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Hove Natanian will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. She said my name better than I ever could. I actually recognized it that time. Your Honors, let me begin with addressing Justice O'Neill's question to Mr. Harris about whether a promise is necessary when you have performance. And the answer to that question under Sheshinoff is yes, a promise is still required. The court in Sheshinoff made the specific holding on page 646 that an at-will employee's non-compete covenant becomes enforceable when the employer performs the promises it made in exchange for the covenant. Performance is necessary, certainly, but the promise is also necessary. The court reiterated that point a little later in the opinion on page 651, where it said, the covenant need only be ancillary to or part of the agreement at the time the agreement is made. Accordingly, a unilateral contract formed when the employer performs a promise that was illusory when made can satisfy the requirements of the act. So there does have to be a promise, and that's dispositive of the issue, in this case, of that particular issue. Because as the Court of Appeals held, there was no promise to provide the consideration for the restrictive covenant. Now, the promise can be express, and that happened in Sheshinoff. It was an express promise where the agreement said the employer will provide confidential information to the employee. And it can be implied. There are cases which have held there's an implied promise. But it can't be implied from the mere fact of performance because that's not logical. In other words...
Well, what if the contract said, we might give you confidential information from time to time. We're not obligated to, but we just might. And if they do, why isn't that then an enforceable promise once it's revealed, if there's a promise also to keep it confidential?
To go the other way. You are, because it's not a promise. That's not a hard and fast promise. That would come under the category of something that's illusory. We might give it to you, then again, we might not.
Well, it's illusory at the time it's made. But
correct.
Why wouldn't performance then make it binding?
I see your point. It does. Under Sheshinoff, it does. But
so then, once the information is given and accepted, why don't the mutual obligations kick in?
They would, Your Honor, if the promise to give the information had been made. And that's the distinction between Sheshinoff and this case. In Sheshinoff, there was an express promise. We will give you confidential information. And the employer gave the confidential information. This court said the fact that you didn't do it when the contract was made doesn't matter. You did it later. And so you took that unilateral contract and performed it. So there's your promise. Okay, but in this case, the distinction is there was no initial promise made to begin with, not express or implied. And what MFSL is asking you to do is to look only at the fact that they did give the confidential information and say, well, therefore, we must have promised to do it.
Maybe I'm just looking at this too simplistically, but it seems if you promise a guy, look, we've got these clients, they need accounting work, come to work for us, we'll pay you, you're going to do the accounting work, they're going to pay us money, and we're going to give you a bunch of that money, and that's going to be your salary, but we don't want you to steal them, okay? We've got clients, you need work. Come work, we'll get the money, we'll give you part of it, but we don't want you to steal them. And so the guy comes to work, and then the guy steals them. Now, why wasn't the coming to work an enforceable agreement?
It was.
The deal was, and why wasn't that part of the ancillary to, we're going to allow you access to these clients from which we get money, you get money, everybody benefits, but we don't want you to steal them from us. And then you do it, and then the guy says, change my mind, I'm going to steal them. Why isn't that breaching an ancillary agreement?
Well, Your Honor, and I have to hasten to point out that that's not what happened here. I understand. I'm probably being a little defensive on behalf of the client.
Hypothetical.
Because Mr. Fielding went into court and filed suit first for the declaratory judgment action first to find out whether, you know, what he was allowed to do and what he wasn't allowed to do. But I think the answer to your question is that is an enforceable agreement. There's an enforceable agreement from MFSL on the one hand to, I'm going to pay your salary and I'm going to give you fringe benefits. The agreement on the other hand, the other side of that coin, is Mr. Fielding's going to work 40 hours a week. Mr. Fielding is going to give his full attention to MFSL and not have a job on the side. But the agreement that we're talking about in this case, the particular agreement, the restrictive covenant, that is what was not ancillary to an otherwise enforceable agreement. It is true that there were other enforceable agreements in the employment contract, but the restrictive covenant wasn't ancillary to any of those. What it would have been ancillary to, if it existed, was an obligation or a promise on the part of MFSL to provide the confidential information to Mr. Fielding in the first place. But, of course, that promise doesn't exist, neither expressly nor impliedly.
But what they really did was introduce him, gave him introductions to people that had work to be done.
Yes, sir.
Forget about all this, you know, all these cases seem to focus on, you know, oh, we've got this secret information. But what they really provided him to was an introduction to people he didn't know who had work to be done. Why isn't that this ancillary to that? That's something. That's worth something. That's what people go to these networking meetings, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. That's worth money.
That's a
valuable thing, those contacts. So why didn't they introduce them to those workers? Why isn't this ancillary to that and enforceable?
Well, Your Honor, because that's not really one of the functions of the employment agreement. If you look at the employment agreement, it doesn't say anything about MFSL will introduce Mr. Fielding to clients and potential clients.
Everybody knew for a fact that's what was going to happen.
Without question. That happens in every case like this. No question about it. But it's not one of the purposes of the employment agreement. Not from MFSL's standpoint, nor from Mr. Fielding's standpoint. And I'll give you an example. There was no consideration for that hypothetical promise in the employment agreement.
There was. He got the work.
He did, Your Honor, but that's the work that he does for MFSL, servicing MFSL's clients.
Well, I mean, he got to know who they were. He got to know all their business. He
correct.
Got to be in a position where he could take it with him if he left.
Agreed, but that's not...
It's something he didn't have before. Why isn't that consideration?
Well, Your Honor, it's not because that's not really the purpose of the employment agreement. It's not one of the purposes of the agreement. In other words, MFSL, I think it's fair to say, did not have in mind when it signed the contract with Mr. Fielding that we are going to introduce you to a lot of people, to a lot of clients that you can service, and maybe down the road, if you leave, they'll leave us and go with you.
Well, it looks like that's the only thing they had in mind.
Well,
you have to buy them back, and it has to be 90%, and it has
right.
to be on this formula. And looks to me like that's the very thing they were thinking.
Well, Your Honor, that's true as far as the restrictive covenant goes, but that sort of brings us full circle. The consideration for the restrictive covenant is what's lacking. The only possible consideration for that would have been, here's the confidential information. We promise, rather, to give you this confidential information. There's nothing wrong with Mr. Fielding leaving and competing at some point in the future. What would be wrong is if Mr. Fielding left, took the confidential information with him, and then went out and used it to solicit MFSL's clients. That was the restrictive covenant. That was the purpose of the covenant. The problem was that there was no promise to provide the confidential information in the first place.
I just don't see why there needs to be if in fact you do get the information,
Your Honor,
which
well,
you're about to do.
Understood. I see your point.
It's a pretty hollow statement to say, right before the guy is shown the file cabinet, I promise to give you access to confidential information. I mean, he can't do his job unless he goes to the file cabinet.
That's true, Your Honor, but it's the promise that's the consideration. That's what this court said in Sheshinov. Repeatedly, the court uses the word promise. The promise is the consideration. And repeatedly, the court pointed out that in Sheshinov, there was an explicit express promise to give the consideration.
What would the harm be if the court said, yes, we said promise then, but we don't think that's necessary? What, I mean, look at it more globally. What
sure.
does that do to employer-employee relations? I mean, is there any reason not to adopt that holding and say, no, the promise is not, it's not critical at all. It's the fact that the employer actually gave information that they, mm-hmm. Everyone knew they wanted and trusted not to go outside of that corporation.
Sure.
What's the harm?
Your Honor, I can see two harms, one practical and one legal. The practical harm is that since Sheshinov came out, which has only been in 2006, a lot of people, a lot of businesses, a lot of companies have arranged their contracts pursuant to what this court said the law was a couple of years ago. The court said what it said in Light, and in particular footnote 6. Then in Sheshinov, the court came along and said, well, let's retreat a little bit from footnote 6 and explain it, but otherwise leave Light alone. And for the court now to say Light and Sheshinov were both wrong, and in fact you don't need a promise at all, I mean, not to tell the court its business, but I think that goes too far. I don't think that's...
I want to make sure we get both of these.
The second, Your Honor, the legal issue or the legal harm I see is that if the court makes that holding, then you've just taken the consideration out of the contract. You've said you don't need consideration.
That's the part I don't understand, because you do get the information.
You do, Your Honor.
Which is something that you didn't have and it's valuable.
You're absolutely right, but it's not the promise. And this court in Sheshinov and in Light said it's the promise that's the key. And that's one reason the Court of Appeals was correct in this case, because it followed Sheshinov and followed Light.
But we do lots of contracts that way. When I go to Walmart and pick up some jeans and take them to the counter, nobody promised me jeans.
True.
They just had them there. And I took them, and I pay for them, and I get to keep them. And that was the consideration. I didn't talk to Sam Walton or anybody else with Walmart. Nobody else made me any promises, but they're just the jeans, and I took them. And everybody understands that's my consideration, because I'll leave the store with them.
Right.
And so if you get the contact of people that are willing to pay you for doing accounting work, even if nobody ever promised you were going to get work, which I think is kind of odd, to say an accounting firm hired me, but they've never promised me I would do any accounting work. Well, what'd they hire you to do, sweep up?
Well, they said that. They didn't say that they would provide confidential information to do the accounting work.
But you include in the agreement, the employee says, I will not disclose confidential information. That statement's meaningless unless it implies some performance on the employer's part.
Well, Your Honor, except the exact statement, not to quibble with the court, but the exact statement is any confidential information. In fact, it's any secret or confidential information or knowledge obtained by the promisor, the employee, Mr. Fielding. So the door is open there with the use of the word any, that none will be provided. And undoubtedly there are cases where none is provided. And I think that, again, that's what distinguishes this case from Sheshinov and other cases where there was an explicit promise that we will provide you the confidential information. That's what's lacking in this case. And Chief Justice Jefferson, that's the conclusion to my answer on the legal harm, is that if the court goes that far, then you've effectively wiped out Sheshinov and said, now you just don't need a promise at all. Now the consideration doesn't have to exist when the contract is made. It'll exist later when we actually provide the information. That's much further than this court went in Sheshinov, much further than this court went in Light. And we respectfully suggest too far for this court to go in this case.
To address the attorney's fees question?
I will, Your Honor. Thank you. If the court reads 1552 and 1551, one particular message comes through from the legislature, and that is the employer is not supposed to get attorney's fees. 1551 awards attorney's fees if certain conditions are met to the person who is defending against the action to enforce the covenant. Well, that obviously is the employee, since employees...
Haven't courts been awarding attorney's fee? If you breach the covenant, you get attorney's fee. And courts have been awarding attorney's fees if you win on your covenant not to compete for a long time.
Not under 1551 and 1552, Your Honor.
But they've been awarding them under something.
I don't disagree. Absolutely, yes.
That's because breach of contract. You always get your attorney's fees if you prevail
under 38001. Absolutely.
And well, so, but wouldn't you continue to do that? What part of this says if they sue? Well, let me ask you first. Are you your client sued? Is not that they breached anything?
Correct. Well, that's correct. We are challenging the restrictive covenant.
But you're
that's
not right. Saying they breached the covenant or they breached any part of the contract.
Correct. Correct. And
I started to ask this. Under statute, if you breach a contract or you recover on the contract, you get attorney's fees. You got but that's covered under this. This preempts statutory or common law.
I believe it does, Your Honor. The wording is so broad, I think it does.
How does the common law get us to wiping out a contractual agreement between the parties?
Well, you know, I'm constrained in this case to agree with Mr. Harris. I think the word otherwise is probably, it says the common law or the law or otherwise. That's an awfully broad term. And I got from it what Mr. Harris got from it, which is that it applies to private contracts between the parties. So I echo his answer to Justice O'Neill, reluctantly, but I echo that answer in that I think it's probably broad enough to cover private contracts between the parties. Certainly, that's how both sides have litigated this case. That's how Judge Jameson, the trial court, looked at it. That's how the Court of Appeals looked at it. So I think that's a fair interpretation.
What do you think a proper disposition would be were you not to prevail? Would it be a render or would it be a remand to assert attorney's fees under the Covenant Not to Compete Act?
Your Honor, I hope that's another one of Justice Brister's hypothetical questions. certainly a remand and not a render. If the court is going to say that the law is going to be a little different than Sheshinov, and the court is going to say you're under the wrong statute, or you're under the wrong provision, then we would respectfully suggest a remand, certainly in the interest of justice, so we can litigate this case under the law as the court decrees it.
But it would be under the interest of justice because you didn't seek attorney's fees under the Act.
Well, if you mean 1551, that's correct.
1551, that's
correct. And I guess We really couldn't because, well, we could if the court says we are defending against an action. In other words, if the counterclaim controls over the claim and we are defending against an action, then yes, we could under 1551.
But I guess what I'm saying is you didn't seek that alternatively.
We did not. We certainly did not argue that in the Court of Appeals or before this court. And the reason is because we think 1552 is clear that if it's an action to enforce a covenant, there's no attorney's fees. But, of course, this is not an action to enforce a covenant.
So it is a race to the courthouse.
Your Honor, it is. It absolutely is. And the reason it is not because of what the Court of Appeals said. It's because of what the legislature said.
What does this do if the court overturns Justice Alcala's opinion and has a new standard here? It seems like it would create more races to the courthouse and just more litigation because now the line has been moved further down the road.
I agree, Your Honor. That's exactly what it'll do. It's always going to be a race to the courthouse. In other words, part of MFSL's brief says, well, that's not fair because you've made it a race to the courthouse, and if the employee gets there first, then preemption is out the window. But see, if you look at the other side of that argument, you would be creating a race to the courthouse that now the employer has the motivation to win. Because if the employer gets there first, then there's no attorney's fees in that event. So either way, it's going to be a race to the courthouse. That's unavoidable. But there's nothing wrong with that. If you look at cases like Perry versus Del Rio, where this court addressed dominant jurisdiction in 2001, the court said it's a race to the courthouse. The winner of the race, that party's suit controls for the purposes of dominant jurisdiction. The Corpus Christi Court of Appeals has also said in regard to medical malpractice cases that 4590I created a race to the courthouse because on the 181st day, either the plaintiff or the defendant needed to do something before the other one. Either the plaintiff needed to file a voluntary non-suit or the defendant needed to file a motion to dismiss with prejudice. The Court of Appeals said it's a race to the courthouse, but it's not our race. That's the way the legislature wrote the statute. And in that event, the race is on. The court can't do anything about the race. And in this case, certainly it's a race to the courthouse, but no matter what the court says, it's going to be. Either the employer or the employee one is always going to be motivated to get to the courthouse first and therefore impact 1552 and 1551's application to the case.
Any further questions?
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court.
I'll first address the issue of whether a promise is required. Fielding has pointed to language in Sheshinoff that talks about the employer performing his promise, and there are two places in the opinion where that language appears. The language quoted at page 646, as well as language over at page 655, where it talks about the employer performing his promise. It appears that the court was simply talking about the facts of the case in both the beginning and end of the opinion where that language appears, because in Sheshinoff, there actually was a promise. There was a promise to provide access to confidential information, and the court construed that as being a promise. So the court was discussing the facts of the case. If you look at the opinion in the discussion, for example, over at page 651, in the discussion of unilateral contracts, the opinion says there's no sound reason why a unilateral contract made enforceable by performance should fail under the act. No mention of promise. Later in the paragraph, if, as in this case, the employer's consideration is provided by performance and it becomes non-illusory, then that should be enforceable and we see no reason to hold the covenant fails. Again, no mention of a promise. The opinion is internally consistent that no promise is required.
What if it's not this kind of situation, which kind of does suggest, you know, that if you're going to hire these employees, you've got to give them confidential information. But what if we're talking in the IT business and an employee comes there, they've got to develop, you know, before they're going to get to the next level and get this information. And so the employer says, you know, if you work here for a time, we're going to give you confidential information. Maybe it's going to take a couple of years for you to work up to that level. And so you join on the hope or this implied promise that at some point you're going to reach the next level, get this information, become more valuable to the employer. Shouldn't there be something like that gives the employee some, you know, idea of why they're there or why they should join that company.
Well, in this case, we do have that, but in your hypothetical situation, often whenever an employee changes positions, when a promotion is done, there may be a new agreement that's entered into at the time that the employee will be receiving the confidential information. That they may have that agreement when this new IT person gets a promotion and they're now in a department or at a supervisory level.
But I'm saying, would an employee be more likely to want to come to a corporation if the promise is made, and if one is not made, well, then maybe I'll find some company that will give me this promise. And what I'm trying to get to is promise an important part of this or not? I mean, I hear your argument saying you don't have to have a promise, implied or expressed, and I'm just wondering if that's good.
I think as a practical point, it may be that the employee likes that promise when the employee is coming to work, and the employee doesn't like the promise so much when the employee is leaving the employment because there are strings that get attached to it. So I think it somewhat depends at the time you're looking at it. Yeah, coming in the door, they like having access to all this important information. They've got a very high-level position, but when they leave and take that business with them.
But they may not go in the first place if they have no assurance that they at least have this this possibility of reaching the next level, of getting, you know, if you're an engineer, you know, and it's a defense project, and that's where you want to be, because once you're there and you get the security clearance, then, you know, later on, I mean, your career goes. You can become a professor. I mean, there's just a lot that comes with access to very, very confidential information. Maybe the employee wouldn't go to that business if they didn't have that promise.
Yeah, and these employment situations are all so unique, depending on what the person is looking for, promotions, et cetera, what is entailed in the position.
And so the question that I'm asking is more a fundamental one. Should we do away with this idea of a promise altogether, or is there some reason to maintain it in the law? And I just don't know the answer.
I don't think there's a reason to maintain it in the law, and I think the court, in essence, I mean, it has done away with it. I mean, that's what is required or what is the issue under the law. Under a unilateral contract, there is only one promise. I mean, for the court to say that we're now going to require a promise in addition to providing the information, I believe the court would have to change the law to do that, because the court would have to now overrule footnote 6 in Light and say that unilateral contracts cannot be sufficient consideration. To require a promise requires a bilateral contract. And it's long been the law in Texas, at least since Light, in the employment and covenant not to compete situation, that a unilateral contract is sufficient performance. And by definition, in a unilateral contract, there's only one promise.
If that's the case, then almost any professional, where you come through college or graduate school or whatever, you have the knowledge, and you go to actual work for a company, almost any professional then who enters into a contract, the employer can put one of these covenants not to compete in, and simply by going to work, for all practical purposes, has agreed not to compete, whatever that contract is, so long as it's reasonable and complies with the other matters. Is that a fair statement where your position would take the law?
And there is actually confidential information that's provided. I mean, that's an important requirement, Your Honor. It's not just that you bring the person in and put the covenant not to compete in. You have to actually provide them confidential information.
Of course, this one says if you acquire it from the employer, its other employees, or its clients. So, and confidential information is a pretty broad category, it seems.
It is, but that term is defined in law, and there are cases that turn on whether the information really is confidential, whether it's available in the public domain. And so there is that requirement that pulls you back in so that you can't just put these in all of those provisions. And on the facts of this case, I mean, Mann Frankfurt is a little different than a lot of other accounting firms in that it sends its employees out. It provides this information. Another way for an employer to do it is to say, we're going to have our employees. We're not going to expose them to clients. We're not going to give them this information. So if they leave, they can't hurt us. I mean, that's one of the decisions the employer has to make, is how much access they're going to give their employees to this confidential information. And when they decide to do that, they should be able to protect it by having an agreement.
Any further questions? Thank you. Counsel, the cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
Rise.